The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It is the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting from seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. We have a terrific show, so I'm going to get through the introduction parts real quick so that we can talk to Dr. Handmer again. And we're on the 60-minute format today, but we will go over, based on your phone calls, your emails, and how our discussion is going. And don't forget, on Sunday is open lines. Our toll-free number for the day is 866-687-7223. Please don't forget we are a talk show, meaning we do actually like to talk. So we certainly prefer calls over emails. But for those of you where email works the best, it is Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And don't forget we're a 501c3 nonprofit listener supported program, and we're able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support us, and that support is absolutely essential for the Space Show and its forward progress and continued programming. As a nonprofit, you do get a tax deduction if you're paying U.S. federal taxes. The same is definitely true in California, and check with your local state or your tax people to see if you get a state deduction wherever you live. That changes state by state, and obviously I don't know the rules for all 50 states, but do check if that's an important benefit that you would like to obtain and have. And as I said, as a nonprofit, we are now coming into the annual fundraising campaign part of the year, between now and the end of the year. And our support takes us through the year 2022. So we are in that campaign period. And if you are listening to the Space Show and you appreciate it and you enjoy it, please do support us. There's a large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is by far the easiest way to support us. And then for those of you who are old school and you want to use a check like I always do, it is made out to One Giant Leap Foundation, goes to Box 95, Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email me. Don't forget our sponsors, and if you want to be a sponsor for 2022, do let me know, but you get the banner ad going across our homepage. On longer format shows, I read a message that you write. It takes about 60 seconds. And on the shorter formatted shows, I shout out to our great sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, and the National Space Society. We'd love to have you on board for a sponsor. If you want details and information, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. For today, we're very, very fortunate to have back with us Dr. Casey Handmer. He has his PhD in physics from Caltech. He is at JPL, but the views that he writes about and expresses, including the views on the Space Show, are absolutely his own. And he has an incredible blog, which all of you should be subscribing to, kchandmer.wordpress.com. His full bio is up on our website. About 2 weeks ago, or a week and a half ago, he wrote a very engaging blog article, which prompted me to invite him back on the show, about NASA and what's going to happen when Starship becomes operational. And we're going to lead off with this because Looks like there's going to be some challenges in how NASA is going to be able to work with, process, handle, however you want to describe it, with Starship. And the question is NASA up to the challenges? Casey, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, David, and thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. So what's the deal with NASA and Starship? They're not properly preparing for Starship capabilities and operations. Give us the introduction and the 101 on this.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go quite that far, but yeah, I think it was, you know, well, sorry to confuse your listeners. I'm just going to back up here and say once again that, you know, what I'm saying here is my own lousy opinion. And, you know, I work at NASA. I actually resigned, but effective next week, I'm going to go and start my own company. But,
terrific.
I want to be completely clear here that what I'm saying here comes from a position of love. It comes from a position of firm belief in NASA's mission and its ability to execute on that mission. I know that some people who've read my blog sometimes misconstrue it as kind of guns blazing criticism. It's not how it's intended. And I really try not to make it come across that way. But with that in mind, I kind of wanted to write a follow-up to a pair of blogs that I wrote 2 years ago exactly, which were talking about Starship and Starlink, and trying to kind of put my thoughts and my background and my physics interpretation of what was trying to be done kind of into the public domain in a way that, you know, if I got involved in a conversation with someone in the world or on Twitter or whatever, I could just refer them back to the blog and say, like, hey, check out this blog. Tell me what you think. You know, if you disagree with it, I really want to know. If you agree with it, that's great. You know, maybe this will help us, you know, have a more interesting conversation in the future. And together with the SLS blog, which I think I was on last time to talk about, I wrote this blog, and for some reason, I don't get very many invitations to talk about my, like, less popular blogs that are kind of dealing with weird esoterica. But the more controversial ones, the ones people want to talk about, that's fine. And so just to kind of drill in here, there's this, you know, 2 years on, essentially, from when I first wrote this Starship blog. You know, the Starship development program that we can all see going on in South Texas has proceeded, really by all accounts, very impressively. They've had their setbacks, they've had their triumphs. I personally follow many different reporters who are constantly taking photos and videos and talking about it because I find it very inspiring. I feel like I'm no longer at the forefront of that. There are many other people who spend a lot more effort than I do kind of understanding the minutiae of how Starship is developing. But at the same time, I think versus 2 years ago, the odds of Starship succeeding ultimately sometime in the next, you know, 3 to 6 years, I guess, in the sense that it becomes a fully rapidly and reusable, rapidly reusable rocket, that's also manufacturable, has increased quite a lot. And kind of in the context of that, I kind of wanted to lay out my concerns for how a successful Starship program may negatively affect the aerospace industry. And I think it's important to note that the impact of Starship, when it succeeds, will overwhelmingly be positive to everyone across the industry in all kinds of ways. But it also has the potential to be negative, and I think that is understudied. My view on the matter is that it's not adequately understood, and it should be understood. It should be studied. It should be feared in some ways, because really, you know, forewarned is forearmed, and if, you know, the industry as a whole, NASA in particular, and JPL in super particular, just because it's my own kind of little home base, are able to think about this strategically, then maybe there's a better chance that you know, when Starship kind of becomes operational and does these things that we've been kind of anticipating forever, increase humanity's ability to launch stuff into orbit by a factor of 1,000, decrease costs by a similar factor, you know, NASA will be prepared to take full advantage of that, rather than potentially cede some of its you know, core areas of competence to competitors who are not necessarily burdened by the same kind of historical context that NASA is embedded within. And so I just kind of wanted to drill into what these negative consequences could be, and how they could be understood and how they could be mitigated against. And I make it very clear throughout this blog that, you know, Starship is not a sure thing. it wasn't 2 years ago, it isn't now, and it won't be until, you know, the day you can, you know, go and put your space probe right on top and send it into space. But as the probability of it becoming a sure thing increases, I think it is probably wise to strategically hedge against negative consequences and positive consequences of that eventuality. First of all, by funding basic kind of investigations and studies as to what can happen, and then informed by those studies, investing in kind of production capacity that's necessary to take advantage of kind of our newfound launch capability. As one example, there are other kind of major structural modifications that can be made to really kind of fully exploit these opportunities. And really, when I look around at discussions both in popular media, within the kind of the surrounding culture of the space launch, but also within various legacy aerospace companies that I'm privy to and within NASA, if to the extent that it occurs at all, most of the Starship conversation seems to be along the lines of, well, I've got this pet mission that I've been trying to get off the ground for 20 years, and Starship could make it possible. Or, Starship offers me the ability to put 100 tons on an asteroid. That's pretty cool. Let me think about all the different scientific missions that I could, or scientific questions that I could answer with that capability. Could we go and, put rovers on new planets and stuff like that? And I think that's a very important conversation to have, because the timeline necessary to kind of be ready to go, as it were, with new instruments and new spacecraft, when that happens, needs to start now, because it takes, 6 to 10 years to kind of build and launch a spacecraft from scratch, which is kind of a long time, actually. In some ways, Starship will have been developed more quickly than the payloads that will fly on it. But what has been missing is kind of the flip side of that conversation, which is, it's relatively straightforward to get an engineer or a scientist into a room and be like, okay, here's 100 tons. Tell me good things you can do with it. I think it's much more difficult to get a program manager into a room and say, Starship means that, your entire institutional competence of hypermass optimization is now irrelevant. How do you feel about that? Or not necessarily irrelevant, but certainly the major constraints that kind of feed into spacecraft design would change drastically under Starship. There would still be constraints, but those constraints would be different. And the way that the spacecraft constructing portions of NASA, including parts of JPL, are kind of structured, really kind of give a strong and necessary institutional emphasis around things like mass optimization in order to deal with the fact that our current fleet of rockets are both expensive and relatively weak in comparison to Starship, and relatively little emphasis on kind of the other aspects of spacecraft design that would be more relevant in this case. So I think that's a pretty good primer.
Based on feedback and what I hear from space show people, which would be listeners and sometime guests, and I want you to comment on this, there seems to be a difference in people's mind and approach and attitudes between government and private sector. So what you described, they would say, okay, yeah, that's government. But Starship is opening the door for incredible commercial opportunities and private sector opportunities, and they move much faster. They're much more efficient. They can do things a lot quicker. So is this as big a concern or deal for the commercial segment as it might be for government?
I think so. I mean, it's important to note that in terms of the space industry, the vast majority of people who work in it work for businesses that are, if not, government agencies, a lot like government agencies, strongly integrated with the government. And that's fine. That's kind of how business gets done. But I don't think we can point to the spacecraft building portions of Boeing or Lockheed Martin and say that these are, incredibly, hard-scrabble, hungry startup kind of environments where everything is done on the smell of an oily rag. And that's kind of how it should be, because building spacecraft is very difficult, very technical, very expensive, very risky, in the sense that you have a lot of kind of institutional overhead in order to manage that process. But I do think that the going forward, Starship has the potential to lower costs to the point where new business models in space are possible, And it's important to kind of realize that up until this point, you know, there are numerous companies that build and operate private communication satellites, Earth observation satellites, and then the agencies that do various scientific missions, Earth observation missions, deep space missions, things like that. But, you know, in terms of the, you know, a vast spectrum of potential economic activity, really it's, you know, the number of business models that are kind of, you know, surefire ways to not lose money at a vast clip in space is really small. And actually right now we're kind of seeing a gradual expansion of that with Starlink rolling out, which is this idea that you can actually kind of provision commercial cost and commercial grade internet from low Earth orbit satellites using thousands and thousands of them and really quite advanced technology. And I think this is kind of a harbinger of things to come. And, you know, it's not impossible, but it's not guaranteed, but I think it is possible that Starship could lower costs to the point where we could see much greater exploitation of space stations in low Earth orbit for potentially for manufacturing, research, tourism. We could see a potential for tourism, just kind of flights in low Earth orbit or even further, like potentially around the moon, which has certainly been discussed. You know, a lot of people are kind of quite ambitious or optimistic about potential for space resources, potentially like asteroid mining or mining on the moon. And I personally am somewhat skeptical of those models, but certainly Starship's cost reduction, potential cost reduction, would enable those assumptions to be tested in a way that they really can't be tested right now. And that's a very exciting thing. And so when it comes to testing those things, I think it is quite likely that we will see new coalitions form and new kind of practices emerge from companies that may traditionally have had most of their business operating in on Earth, potentially in quite hostile environments or heavily industrialized environments on Earth, but nevertheless not really known for doing this, that much space work. And kind of the one I usually pick on is Caterpillar, although there are, you know, hundreds of major industrial companies in the United States alone that are really kind of naturally positioned to capitalize on this opportunity should the moon take them. And the reason I pick on Caterpillar is that they make, you know, a lot of heavy machinery. And the heavy machinery is you know, all-terrain capable. It's quite rugged. It's designed to be low maintenance. It already, in many cases, has functional remote control autonomy hardware built in. And so the number of modifications necessary to make this work on the moon, for example, is relatively small in terms of, you know, retrofitting certain components to prevent off-gassing and vacuum and deal with you know, greater temperature variations and things like that. But you know, it's certainly impossible to launch, you know, a major, like a large Caterpillar tractor to the moon or something on existing spacecraft because the heavy machinery is heavy. It's made of steel plate. And that's just, you know, up to this point, it's been completely inconceivable to be able to make spacecraft in that way and to be able to get them into space because it's, you know, so difficult to launch things. So I think that's a really potentially exciting thing. Caterpillar is an enormous company. It's not exactly a, you know, a hardscrabble startup either. Now, in terms of exploiting potential cost improvements from Starship, I'm not kind of overly idealistic here. I do not expect SpaceX to sell Starship launches any more cheaply than they currently sell Falcon launches. Up until, you know, the point where a competitor comes along with competitive technology and is able to undercut them in order to gain market share. And I think that will occur ultimately. But in the meantime, I think companies should keep an eye on the fact that they're unlikely to get a discount from SpaceX unless the product that they're offering has a really strong synergy with SpaceX's kind of long-term goals, which is kind of cool because I think buying into those goals is a pretty neat thing to do for, you know, a industrial coalition. You know, why shouldn't Aaron Connect and Caterpillar and DuPont and 3M and Halliburton come to the table and say, well, you know, we have decades of institutional experience in doing all the kinds of things that you want to do on the moon and on Mars, building bases, you know, running Antarctic stations, doing drilling underground, you know, setting up power plants, doing large-scale mineral extraction. You know, we'd like to be part of that. And, you know, we can be part of that, what is a reasonably trivial fraction of our annual R&D budget, but would be an enormous improvement and help when it comes to recruiting and talent retention, and, you know, in addition to branding rights and prestige. You know, can be part of that. And I think that's a conversation that really should be happening now. And I think it already is occurring in some sessions, but one of the things I love doing is jumping on my blog, banging my drum that, like, this needs to happen. Make this happen. I can't personally make it happen. I don't operate Caterpillar's R&D department, but I'm sure some of your listeners will know people and can kind of start thinking about how to go about exploiting these opportunities.
I have an involved email from a listener. We refer to Doug as Dr. Doug in Redlands, California. Doug, actually, if your phone line is good, this seems more appropriate for a phone discussion than an email, but let me try. Casey, can you describe when you think that the policy tipping point ought to occur, when policy should turn from SLS to Starship? And then he lists quite a few items. First flight to orbit, first recovery of the Super Heavy booster, first refueling in LEO, first recovery of Starship from orbit, Dear Moon, first landing on the moon, first landing on Mars. Thanks, Doug in Redlands. So are you following his question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So thanks, Doug. That's an interesting question. I can't really give you the answer that you want, unfortunately. NASA's in something of a quandary as far as SLS goes, because the reasons for its unreasonably large expense and long delays are partly out of its control. And the reason for its existence is entirely out of its control. Congress told NASA to build SLS the way that SLS has been built. In an ideal world, you could imagine the administrator being able to form an argument that can convince senators not to do it. But at the end of the day, the senators are going to do what they were elected to do, which is, look out for the interests of their state. And frankly, the administrator is a public servant who serves the elected representatives and by extension, the American people. So that's kind of something that NASA just has to deal with. But it is interesting now. SLS is finally getting stacked, and I have friends who work on it. And I wish them every success. I don't want to see SLS, explode or anything. I don't think it's safe enough to launch humans on, or ideally even major rovers and things like that. And I go into vast detail on this on my blog about SLS, which no doubt you've read. But I think the question kind of asks, like, at what point would NASA or Congress be forced to kind of realize the obvious? And I suspect that the way we'll get around this is by recognizing it's not an either-or. And in fact, NASA, Starship is cheap enough that NASA should be able to exploit using it, as they have indicated they'd like to with the HLS program, without necessarily, ceasing work on the SLS. And that's probably the way that it'll go forward in the interim. I've not really followed SLS too closely recently, because I was quite surprised by the report that came out a couple of weeks ago about a white paper about essentially offloading its operation to a private company, in much the same way as the shuttle was in its final years, with the hope that this could increase the cadence and reduce costs by about 50% now that development costs are kind of fading away. While this is an interesting point, I think everyone listening to this radio show would recognize that that even reducing SLS cost by 50% is not adequate to make it competitive with basically any other launcher on Earth, let alone Starship. And so it's kind of a bit of a pickle, frankly. But I do look forward to all those milestones that you outlined. And for me personally, I think the next major milestone is getting a Starship back from orbit, and you're kind of validating their entire kind of launch structure, and then reflying a Starship that's been to orbit. I think that would be pretty neat, and ideally one a Starship coming in from a hyperbolic trajectory, from the moon or deep space, at the necessarily higher speeds that involves. It's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge. But one of the things that I pointed out in the most recent blog about all this stuff is that the really big unknown unknowns, if you like, or known unknowns in terms of Starship development, the major technical risks have largely been retired. There's still a lot of work to be done, but it's no longer kind of we're not sure if this is possible according to the laws of physics, that, you know, a full-flow stage combustion cycle engine could be capable of flying a Starship off the ground and landing it. Like, that has been done. It's no longer unknown whether the flap kind of belly flop control can work. That can be done. It's no longer unknown if you can build an airframe out of stainless steel in the way that they did. And really, the remaining unknowns are kind of like, well, will their fancy heat shield system work properly? Well, we don't know yet. I suspect they're going to have some headaches there. But if it doesn't, we have other heat shield technologies that exist that's just not as good, right? It's more expensive or it weighs more. But you can just use it, you know, and it's got an extremely long flight heritage. And in fact, SpaceX even makes it themselves for the Dragon capsule, so it's not the end of the earth if they have to use that. So I feel like most of the, say, 95% of the remaining major technical risks, there already exists a, high maturity, technical approach that we know will work, that isn't ideal, but it will work. And so I think that's very encouraging.
I have an email from you from Bill in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, I've heard many people make the argument that SLS will prevail because it's a national rocket committed to the national service and priorities of the government, where a commercial rocket, SpaceX or anybody else's rocket, might have other priorities rather than national priorities. Therefore, it's important that the government keep a national priority rocket on hand. Do you have any thoughts on that argument?
Yeah, I think NASA's policy generally is to avoid competing with industry. And I think that's probably wise. I think, like, you know, in the broader scheme of things, the space flight part of NASA, at least, or technology part of NASA, is kind of best known for being a bridge between academic lab research, although a lot of that goes on at NASA as well, and commercialization. And so what tends to happen is technologies are kind of invented or brought to NASA. They're matured there. They're kind of developed. They're studied. After 5 or 10 or 15 years, those technologies become mature enough that they can be, you know, produced and operated by third parties. So they kind of transcend their science experiment status, and then they can kind of get spun out as businesses that may or may not succeed. If you look at the history of kind of NASA-originated inventions that have subsequently kind of leaked out into the rest of society, it's an enormous list of absolutely incredible stuff. It's a real testament to the power of that model. As I think your writer, questioner alluded to, NASA recognizes that it's quite difficult for the kind of NASA internal cost structures and salary structures and basically the way they operate to compete in a commercial sense with a company that's actually built a business around specializing in producing, you know, one of these widgets, whatever that widget may be. And there are good reasons for that. I don't think you can point the finger at NASA and say, well, you can't compete because you're wasteful. I think NASA says, well, our job here is done. We've incubated this device, which is now generating enormous wealth for, some commercial sector, and improved everyone's life. You're welcome. And that's kind of the funny thing about SLS because, you know, it's been reasonably clear that at least in the form of ULA, like Boeing and Lockheed were able to build launch vehicles that, you know, were more cost competitive than Shuttle, and could have been human rated, and in fact are about to be human rated. But nevertheless, you know, NASA's internal rocket building capability was, you know, politically important, and so it was maintained. But it's not really a surprise that it turned out to be struggled to compete with companies who basically live and die on whether their rockets can get enough customers. And I think that really, really helped SpaceX focus their attention on building a saleable product with Falcon. And that's kind of a problem they have to deal with. So yeah. In terms of the national rocket, well, I don't know. I don't think I fully understand all that rhetoric, so I think I might not comment on the specifics.
Linda sent in a note from Olympic, Washington, and listeners, we'd love to have you call. The line is available, 866-687-7223. But Linda's email says, earlier in the discussion, you mentioned negatives for Starship. What are the negatives for Starship that we should be studying or prepared for?
Yeah, so thanks, Linda. Olympic is a beautiful place. So, I didn't kind of go into detail yet in this phone call, or on the show about what those negatives could be. And really, the whole point of my blog was to argue or advocate in favor of funding internal studies where people who actually kind of know what they're talking about can enumerate these possibilities. But the kind of major risk that I can see from a distance is the same risk that kind of applied to, companies like Kodak or Motorola. You know, these companies that used to be household names, some of the biggest companies on earth, incredibly powerful, decades of dominance in their respective industries, and then almost overnight lost their competitive edge and disappeared. And really, if you kind of read into detail about how this occurred, the reason it occurred is because the people within the company were aware of competitive threats. They'd successfully fought off competitive threats for decades. But the company gets to a certain point, a certain size, a certain age, and it overestimates the magnitude of a new threat, having successfully dealt with threats in the past, and it underestimates its ability to adapt to a new market or to successfully counter these threats. And in particular, you know, the set of actions that a company feels that it can reasonably take is a subset of the actions that it actually can take, and it's also doesn't overlap with the set of actions that it needs to take in order to survive. And so there are a handful of examples of major companies that have entered this situation and have survived, but they've only done so by essentially throwing out their entire kind of management philosophy, which is by this point, you know, largely calcified, and really kind of adopting a much more risk-focused posture. And so in terms of, to get into specifics in terms of NASA, I alluded to earlier that, in terms of launching stuff into space, everyone who launches stuff into space, is deeply concerned about mass optimization to the point that, you know, essentially the entire architecture of missions to Mars or launching CommSats to low Earth orbit or anything like that is dictated by, how much mass you can afford to spend on various subsystems. And in turn, that flows into all the other different things that make spacecraft hard, like dealing with thermal and power and communications and all the other stuff. So, and propulsion and so on. It's all about mass. Mass is just a huge problem, right? But as Paul Wooster pointed out in his Mars Society conference talk circa 2018, I think, mass, the ability to launch a lot of mass covers a lot of sins. And this is actually something that the Soviet space program understood early on when their launches were much more powerful than American ICBM launches because their nuclear bombs were less compact. And as a result, they gave them an early lead in the space race because they had bigger rockets to work with. And so they could make do with, spacecraft that didn't have quite the same degree of miniaturization that the Americans had by that point achieved with their computer technology and that sort of thing. And so the result of that is that, the spacecraft building divisions of Lockheed, of Boeing, of Northrop Grumman, the various NASA vendors, including JPL, and then frankly, all their kind of, friends all around the world, spend a lot of effort figuring out how to make things really light. And one obvious example I can give you is that the Mars rover is all made out of very, very strong alloys of titanium and aluminium, which are very light metals. And then those instead of being like riveted or forged or whatever, generally speaking, they start off with a big block of material, and then they machine it down. They use a machine to carve off most of that material. Like 99.9% of that material just gets turned into waste, and it gets recycled. But it's enormously labor and cost intensive to do this process. But the result is that you end up with a part that is, the perfect shape. It's exactly as strong as it needs to be, and it's exactly the right shape in order to have the strength that it needs to perform its role, and not an iota more. Like the mass margin might be 0.5% or something. But the result of this is it's enormously expensive to design and qualify and test and build these spacecraft because, every last subsystem has to be, have all the mass squeezed out of it. And not to belabor the point, but I heard from a friend of mine that for the Perseverance rover, which is the most recent rover that NASA launched to Mars, the instrument mass subsystem parts, like the masses of all the different parts of all the different instruments was tracked to a tenth of a gram, which is about the weight of a postage stamp on a rover that weighs about 1,000 kilograms or 10 million times as much. So they're kind of sweating the small stuff down to 7 decimal places in order to keep the mass down. But this isn't the only reason that rovers are building spacecraft is incredibly expensive. But in terms of, the cost of doing business for an organization like JPL, a lot of that is due to the overhead of keeping, a team of hundreds of mechanical engineers and technicians and so on around to operate these machines, to do this mass optimization, to build these incredibly light rovers. something that is the size of an SUV that weighs about as much as a heavy motorcycle. And the thing is, just because you can now build rovers that don't have that mass optimization and launch them on a Starship based on a mid-size Caterpillar tractor, doesn't mean that those people don't still have to be paid their salary. And so either you find a new thing for them to do, which is kind of compatible with their skill set, or you just kind of have to lay them off, or you have to pay for them somehow, even though, the relative contribution that they were providing to the overall value of the mission has been undercut by an external market change. And so that kind of seems like a major risk to me, because it leaves open the opportunity or possibility for competing contractors to either produce spacecraft for NASA or to produce their own spacecraft, either for science with private funding or for commercial purposes, that they kind of sidestep all these challenges that have kind of been burned into the brains of designers going back forever, and build something new much more cheaply because they don't have to worry about that constraint anymore. And in fact, if you kind of take the most optimistic possible future point of view of Starship, and you say, well, we're going to go as a species from 500 tons per orbit per year to 1 million tons per orbit per year. How do we go about saturating that supply, that glut of supply, right? How do we go about doing that? Well, actually, the major problem we have to deal with now is not mass optimization, it's mass production. We need to be producing more things, maybe producing 100 rovers a year, or maybe just producing one really big heavy rover, maybe just launching, blocks of cement to space for no reason. But that would be a kind of silly thing to do. But overall, like the problem becomes one of like, how do you get this manifest full? And I think, SpaceX is on top of this. They're like, oh, well, we're going to be building and maintaining a constellation of 30,000 low Earth orbit satellites and building a moon base and building a Mars base. All of which requires, especially for the deep space work with Starship, an awful lot of launches of just fuel. But for third parties, this is an opportunity that, they should get involved with because, ultimately, SpaceX has this goal of building a self-sustaining city on Mars. And to do that, they need to employ technology in 9 or 10 key technology areas, such as, habitats, solar farms, air mining, ground mining, water extraction, spacesuits, teleoperation, in-space manufacturing, all that kind of stuff. And there are other companies that kind of have expertise in these areas or adjacent areas. But the risk that they face is that they don't do anything, right? And then all their young, ambitious engineers take a pay cut and move to Texas to work on it. And then SpaceX kind of over a period of 2 or 3 years ends up verticalizing in this new industry that they didn't previously work in, but they had to in order to do their mission. And as a result, the state of the art in that particular industry advances by 10 or 15 years. And SpaceX can then spin off that technology to go and compete with the incumbents. And this has already happened with Boring Company, right? And Boring Company has not really been emphasized to the point where it's, pushed Heron Connect out of business yet, but which is another major tunnel boring machine company. But if I was a Heron Connect executive, I'd be extremely worried because, in a sense, the beast has been blooded. We have now seen that it is possible to build tunnel boring machines more cheaply that operate more quickly, more reliably, than what was previously thought to be, quote unquote, good enough in an industry. And so, like the carrot and the stick, right? The carrot is like, well, you join in and you become a supplier to SpaceX and you supply them with life support systems or something. And you get, you get some money, you get some prestige, you get a recruitment boost. You get to be part of the most exciting thing that humanity has ever done. That's great. But the stick is if you don't do it, then SpaceX is going to take your business sooner or later. And so it's kind of like, I feel like this is a more or less obvious consequence of the observation that the Starship is going to change this industry completely. And because, I really see very little movement in across all these industries in this direction, I think that Starship is not fully understood. People don't understand that this step change increase in human capacity and capability launched up to orbit will actually change a whole bunch of related industries. That was a rather long answer.
You have another note from our listener, Doug, in Southern California. Doug, I really wish you'd call to do these, but this is another longer email. May I suggest several risks with Starship compared to SLS? Lack of heritage hardware and ops, no launch escape system, acoustics energy, environmental risk of an explosion on the pad, the safety issues that Blue Origin has identified, potential dependency upon one person, Elon. I won't mention recovery of the first stage, recovery of second stage, or LEO refueling because SLS won't attempt those. I would be curious if you think any of these are significant risk.
Yes, Doug. Again, great question. I think they're significant risks. I think the risks are understood by the designers. I think that they're designed around. David, can you refresh my memory? What was the first one listed there?
Lack of heritage hardware and ops, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's probably safe to say at this point that SpaceX has more experience in launch and spacecraft operation than anyone else. Because already Starlink constellation has almost as many satellites as everyone else combined, and pretty soon we'll have more satellites than everyone else combined has ever launched. And in terms of launch, you know, they've just I think completed their 100th consecutive successful Falcon 9 launch. They launch more than everyone else combined. So in terms of operations, I'm not too concerned. I think they know what they're doing. I'm sure if anyone from SpaceX is listening to this, they'll be reassured to know that some random guy in California thinks that they know what they're doing. In terms of flight heritage components, well, it's true that SLS is built on top of the shuttle technology stack. But as I kind of point out in the SLS blog, it's not particularly controversial to say that the space shuttle really never fulfilled its original design criterion. And part of the reason that it did that was that all the different subsystems that was built were kind of built through a set of requirements that were never really met. And so as a result, you know, the sales pitch was, oh, well, we'll just use the shuttle main engines because despite the fact that they're enormously expensive and also reusable, but we'll be throwing them in the ocean, at least they've been shown to work. The fact is that they never met their original design requirements, which was that they could operate, you know, dozens of missions consecutively between being refurbished. In fact, instead, after every mission, they had to get taken apart completely and put back together and retest fired. And if jet engines on planes, for example, had to operate this way, we wouldn't be able to operate the airline industry. And in fact, early jet engines were extremely unreliable in just this way, and for many of the same reasons, namely their turbine stability, but turbine mechanical stability, amongst other reasons. But you know, the technology has improved, and I think, you know, it's probably fair to say that SpaceX knows as much as anyone does about longevity of turbine blades. I think a lot of the shuttle tech stack actually derives from Apollo era hardware, so it's almost 100 years old in some cases. And you know, it kind of has all these architectural issues baked in, where the shuttle designers kind of try to solve their problems by just adding complexity. And the problem is that you know, they in some ways never completed development, and in other ways the original designers are mostly no longer with us. And so it's kind of in many ways, and I think the history of the development of SLS has borne out this observation. Even more risky to use quote unquote flight heritage hardware when the knowledge and skills to operate it safely no longer exists, and in some cases never existed, and in a few cases could never have existed, even if you know, time and money had been spent on it. So I think we'll kind of have to see watch and wait and see. I think the second question Doug had was about acoustic environment. My understanding is that the Europa Clipper was originally meant to launch on SLS, but got bumped to Falcon Heavy because SLS's use of the solid rocket boosters actually greatly increases the acoustic loads on payloads. So my belief is that this Starship will probably have the most benign launch characteristics of any rocket ever flown, just because of the number of its size and, you know, inertia, but also it has a large number of rockets, and so the effect of them is they tend to cancel part of the noise of each other out. Is that reasonable? I think that's reasonable. Time will tell. I also think that SpaceX has already kind of provided estimates in their Starship user guide for their best estimates for what G-loading and acoustic loading of spacecraft will be. So we'll see. I think gone are the days when in order to launch to space, you have to show that you're capable of enduring, you know, 7 Gs at 10 hertz vibrations, because modern rockets are just much better designed. I think you had a third question as well, David?
He talks about the environmental risk of an explosion on the pad, safety issues that Blue Origin has identified, and Musk being a one-person operation. Or dependencies on one person.
I'm certainly worried about about, you know, so much riding on Musk's shoulders. I don't know how he does it. But yeah, there's a certain amount of momentum there. And I trust that he has, you know, quote unquote, set up a foundation or something. So in the event of an untimely demise, you know, his resources can continue to be directed towards his mission. But yeah, I think it would be very reassuring for me if there was, you know, a fairly obvious internal heir to the you know, technology part. That said, I think it's often a misconception that Elon is the person, you know, personally catting up and pushing all these parts out. He has a large number of extremely competent, very experienced engineers that run these programs largely for him. And yes, he gets involved at all levels of the program in all kinds of ways. But generally speaking, you know, there's a lot of very smart people there. In terms of blowing up on the pad, well, yeah, I mean, we're launching rockets, that can happen. I'm not convinced that SLS is necessarily any safer from that perspective.
I don't know what the safety issues Blue Origin pointed out. Are you aware of that?
Well, this, I think, is a reference to Blue Origin's protest and then lawsuit regarding the HLS selection, which I think they, you know, just came back. They were denied a couple of days ago, and to their credit, said, well, we'll get on with it now. I don't really want to kind of tell Blue Origin what to do, but I feel like that was a misstep, a strategic misstep, because, yeah, of course, you've got to occasionally, like, yeah, if you're dealing with a monopsonistic buyout, right, like NASA's basically their only customer if they want to launch humans to the moon, it is important to tell them, to show them that you mean business, and every now and then it means you have to sue your only buyer, your only customer, but at the same time, just the way the whole thing was handled, I think, did enormous damage to Blue Origin's brand and probably made their ability to recruit the right sorts of people more difficult. So, yeah, in terms of what they complained about, Blue Origin correctly identified the fact that using Starship as the HLS lander from the Gateway is kind of weird, and that it would rely on a bunch of technology that, you know, hasn't yet been demonstrated, you know, no one's ever done anything like it before. If you use Starship as the lander, would mean that you're just using a single rocket, both lander and ascent vehicle, whereas the other two proposals had a three-stage system. A vehicle that would take you, sorry, a stage that would take you from the Gateway to low lunar orbit, a stage that would take you from low lunar orbit to landing, and a stage that would take you from the surface back to Gateway. But overall, in the defense of Starship, I would say that, yes, Starship, no one's ever built or flown something like Starship before, but if you look at the first derivative, if you look at the trend, it's definitely in the right direction. And in many ways, I think it's more likely that Starship will successfully execute on its mission than anyone else will be able to deliver a modern lunar lander that meets the HLS criteria. Although I think that Blue Origin should try, and I think if they gave it maximum effort, I'd give them like 20% odds of getting the next human on the moon first, which I think is something that Jeff is very excited by the possibility of. And maybe having exhausted legal options, they'll have to resort to actually just building the hardware and doing it. I think it's far from the foregone conclusion that the other two proposals, the national team and the Dynetics proposal, could have successfully or safely delivered on their mission as well. And in fact, in some ways, their proposals were architecturally hobbled by kind of constraints within the HLS proposal RFP. And again, this is sort of the esoterica that I love talking about, so thank you for asking this question. Just to kind of give you a quick one-minute summary of that, the RFP asked for the ability to land 9 to 12 tons of cargo on the moon using a three-stage system that goes from the lunar gateway, which is in a high orbit around the moon, because the Orion service module and EUS for Starship weren't funded, so haven't been built. So Orion can't really get into low lunar orbit and come back. And so the result of that is you end up with an architecture that is, to put it nicely, baroque, and to be slightly less nice, very strange for trying to actually, you know, sustainably move people to and from the moon and potentially move enough cargo there to actually get anything done. So SpaceX turned around and bid for it as well, and they said, well, you know, we appreciate that you know, you asked for, you know, basically a small three-stage lander, but we don't have a small three-stage lander. We have an extremely large one-stage go-anywhere rocket, and you can have it, I guess. his our proposal. Oh, and by the way, our proposal is you know, a half or a quarter the price of anyone else. And this is kind of the point. I wrote a blog about this a while ago, which is that Artemis can succeed using Starship. It became fairly clear to me, even before Biden was elected, that Artemis was going to really struggle to get humans on the moon by 2024, let alone any time at all, with the kind of standard HLS architecture, just because it kind of relied on so many moving parts that didn't exist yet. And would be extremely expensive to build, and even if you went to the effort of building and qualifying them, wouldn't really deliver much capability. But at the same time, Starship came along and kind of broke the game in a way that I don't think anyone was expecting it to, and in a really good way. And so I think if you're looking at doing moon bases, you can actually just cut the lunar gateway out completely and launch Starships directly from the Earth to the moon and then return them directly from the moon back to the Earth. And you could use the Starship to launch hundreds or even possibly thousands of tons of cargo to the moon. Certainly multiple Starships can launch thousands of tons of cargo to the moon in a year for less than the cost of a single landing with the other approach. And I think that's kind of the, outside the box, breaking the game kind of approach that we need. Because I don't think kind of reconstituting Apollo can really kind of deliver major changes in what we can do on the moon over and above what Apollo did. But something, like Starship, doesn't have to be a SpaceX's Starship. I mean, anyone could build one. NASA could build one. China could build one. Russia could build one. Blue Origin could build a Starship. But it just kind of speaks to a level of ambition that is very encouraging. So I hope that answers that question.
Well, do you see the Gateway being scrapped in this plan and something like Starship taking over the plans to get to and from the moon from Earth?
That's impossible to predict because what I can say is that I would be extremely surprised if any large amount of people or cargo ever go to the moon via Gateway. I think it's possible that Gateway will be kept and until the point where it forces the entire Artemis program to be cancelled. I don't think it'll be out the door first, if that makes any sense. But I think, at some point it'll become unignorable that basically all the primary goals of Artemis and then some can be achieved with Starship. And all you need to do is kind of spend discovery class mission levels of money. It's not even like flagship levels of money on it, and it can be done. And then my personal view is that anyone who has the ability to pay for that would be silly not to, because the problem is solved. Everyone can slap themselves in the back. And actually, if you want to operate a human occupied space station around the moon, ideally in low lunar orbit, that'd be pretty cool. One of the stable orbits. Then I think you could use Starship to do that too, or a Starship-like vehicle to do that too. But I think if your listeners take one thing away, I think the era of we're going to do things in space and we're going to do it with 15 or 20 different modules kind of built by different people and developed over 10 years and integrated, and each one has a reasonably marginal net contribution to the overall value of the project is over. And it should be kind of cheerily waved at in the rear mirror, because I think the promises of kind of modularizing capabilities in space did not bear out, and it just kind of added a lot of cost and complexity and time to programs. The ISS is a very obvious example in that case.
So this is a little out of place in the discussion, but why not?
Go for it.
June in Denver, Colorado. Says, interesting what you're saying about the old way using modules. My understanding is that Bezos' orbital reef program that he just announced relies on various modules in a big infrastructure station that he and the partners plan to build, but a module might exist for space tourism or a hotel or for manufacturing. Isn't that signifying that the era you're talking about is not over?
Well, thanks, June, I think that was, in Colorado. I saw Orbital Reef and I thought that's really cool. And actually, shout out to Jeffrey Montes, who's one of the architects who contributed to the design, which I think it's a great design. It's very inspiring. As I said before, I'm not convinced that, running space stations in low Earth orbit is necessarily a functional business without, a major anchor tenant in the form of NASA just doing it for national prestige reasons or something. but it might be, and we won't know if we don't build it. And I think the Origin should absolutely build it and test that proposal and find out the answer, because there's no other way of finding out. And Orbital Reef is a great way of doing that. Now, in terms of modules and stuff, I think it's important to kind of draw a distinction between something like a two-module space station, like some of the early satellite stations, the ISS, and then what Orbital Reef has in mind. So the critical difference between ISS and Orbital Reef is that Orbital Reef is really kind of a hub and spoke model. So it doesn't look like a hub and spoke, but there's a hub, which is the central axis. And that's just kind of three identical, structurally identical modules that are bolted together end to end. And that forms the backbone of the space station. It provides the power, it provides the living space, it provides a whole bunch of other things, and a bunch of docking ports, and some big windows, which is, again, good stuff, right? And then it has the ability for third party, modules to navigate to the space station, be grabbed with a robot arm and plugged on. And then the space station can provide those modules with power, with water, with other basic infrastructure, right? But at no point does the space station depend, the core part, the hub part of the space station depend on the functionality of those additional modules. And so if there's a problem, you can just close the door and throw it away, right? But you can't do that on the ISS. The ISS is built in such a way, and it took like 30 years to build, and it cost $500 billion to build and operate, and which is incredibly expensive, incidentally. And the way it was built meant that, essentially all the different modules are different, and they all are interdependent on each other, and each one adds additional marginal requirements to the overall design. And so successfully performing the system integration is incredibly complex and very, very expensive. And because you've got modules with different designs from different countries with different ages, the maintenance load is enormously high, because the astronauts who are trained to maintain it have to be familiar with systems that were designed before they were born, in addition to systems that were designed since their children were born. The net result of that is of the six people on the ISS, at any one time, five of them are just performing basic station maintenance, which is necessary on one hand, but at the same time, if the whole point of the space station was to enable an on-orbit laboratory where people could do research into microgravity, it would be ideal if you didn't have to spend, 80 to 90% of your human power spending just kind of keeping the lights on. And I think Orbital Reef, recognizes that reality and takes major steps in the way of doing the best they can with the New Glenn launcher to avoid negative consequences of that reality. So just to kind of recap, we've got three structurally identical modules integrated to form a central hub. So they're all consistent. They've all got the same basic infrastructure on board there. And also structurally, they're mounted together in such a way that when the space station moves, they don't kind of fatigue the joints as much and necessarily start getting cracks like some of the Russian modules are on the space station. The modules are also very big, so they're not spending most of their mass and effort on just endless doors that are never used. And then the hub, the spokes, if you like, the add-on modules, as long as they comply with, the docking adapter and your basic, not off-gassing horrible things or poisoning people, they can be added and removed. At least the hope is, without imposing additional marginal constraints on the capability of the central core, that then drives up the difficulty of design. So I hope that kind of draws enough conclusions. But I also think that ultimately the Orbital Reef, it's kind of a step in the right direction, but it also, if it turns out that mass-producing stuff in space is a viable business, Orbital Reef is not architecturally able to extend to that level, right? You couldn't build a factory in Orbital Reef. You need to do something completely different, and that means you'd have to start the design again from scratch, which is kind of a quandary one has to deal with here, which is how much effort should we put into developing technology that in our best-case scenario is a dead end? And I think that's something that SpaceX kind of learned some hard lessons on when they qualified Falcon Heavy. And I think the rest of the industry would do well to kind of follow on from those lessons.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you.
Yes.
Good morning, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, basically, one question I keep having about this whole Starship heavy lift thing. How much do we have any idea how much money SpaceX has spent developing this thing, let's say up to the point of the first launch of this thing? Or, I mean, they seem to be moving at record time and doing awesome things. And I'm like, does anybody have any idea how much this is costing them? Can they? I would think that, you know, just,
yes.
Go on, John.
Yeah. Well, that's my point. What do you think it costs? I mean, I'm looking at, you know, what we've spent on, let's say, SLS up to now, and, you know, how many years was involved in that? And, you know, I'm just saying, is I mean, are they spending billions doing this, or tens of billions, or are they that incredibly efficient? This just seems amazing to me what they're doing. Is there any reaction?
I totally agree, John. My understanding is that the net investment in Starship, well, it's kind of a complicated question, right? Because the real cost was building the team that's able to design something like Starship. And that team was honed over, you know, decades of investment optimizing Falcon 9,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, funded one way or another. And by and large, SpaceX is still a privately held company, so it hasn't, you know, quote unquote, ever paid back the development costs of its rockets, right? It's raised money to build, it's raised equity. Money through equity sales to build new rockets. And the same thing goes, I think, for Starship. And you know, I think some time ago, they were a little bit more restricted in terms of how much money they could afford to spend on it. But since then, Elon has become vastly more wealthy, thanks in part to Tesla. And at the same time, the Starlink business model has been accepted in a way that the Starship hasn't quite been yet. And numerous kind of funding venture capitalists and stuff came on board and basically handed over as much money as Elon asked for, like to the tune of, I think, $1 billion. I think they raised $1 billion to build Starlink. And a lot of that money is being spent on Starship development. That's basically what I've been able to deduce from reading the industry news about it. In terms of estimating how much money they spend, well, you just estimate the workforce and then multiply by standard app rate and come up with a number. And I would suspect that it's kind of, it'll be in the kind of mid billions by the time they're done, mid single digit billions, which is not too bad. The Saturn V and the space shuttle both cost roughly 10 times that much. The SLS is 20 billion and counting, and Orion is also in the multiple billions. So it's I think it's it's a different approach to design and engineering and anything. And I think it's important to, as a caveat, to say, well, just because, if you have $1 billion, you want to go and build a Starship, you can't just kind of go to Texas and start welding metal together. It really helps to have the team that already built SpaceX with you. And I think a lot of people will learn that lesson in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I can see that because all these other programs are so stretched out that you're probably just maintaining a certain amount of overhead costs for literally decades. Like take Orion, for instance. I mean, that goes back to mid-2000s. And so you're talking about 16, 17 years here, and you've had to have the staff that's running that thing, this engineering staff, the whole time, and very little production, basically. So, but this has been full... I mean, he's running almost like what you might do during a development program, like during World War II, to develop a new aircraft, like the B-29 or something. I mean, it's a no-holds-barred, do it, kind of approach, right?
Yeah. Well, they're running ships around the clock down in Boca Chica, right? So, like, production ships. So, like...
Deliberate ships, yeah.
Yeah, the workforce waxes and wanes, right? They haven't hired everyone in salary. Like, they've got a lot of work, they hire more people. I think the realization there is that this is not a problem that's going to solve itself. You have to bring every tool you have to bear and solve it. And one of the major costs is time. There's a burn rate. Fortunately, SpaceX has realized, but unfortunately, most people don't realize that you can't just kind of spend the money half as fast and the program will take twice as long. It actually takes longer than that because people involved age out. They retire. They move to another job. They forget what they were doing. Yeah, there's a lot to be said for keeping programs really as quick as they can possibly be, and I think the history of large scale new technology developments or infrastructure projects has shown that projects that are structured around rapid execution, in a way that can actually be achieved, generally are the ones that we end up kind of looking back on and being like, wow, that's amazing. you know, like the Empire State Building built in a year. The Eiffel Tower built in, I think, less. It's really, you know, and this is a long time ago. I think the ancient Romans managed to build the what is now called the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul in 6 years, which was considered an extremely long period of time by those standards. But it involves building a dome that's like 50 meters wide or something, like so far off the ground, and the building has stood for 1,500 years. And meanwhile, I just, you know, just to kind of comment, I saw the Astrophysics Decadal Survey came out yesterday, and this is kind of the decadal survey, but they basically determined what will be done through to the early 2040s, including, you know, very, very long-term technology development of some of these telescopes. And part of me wonders, like, yeah, it's certainly true that if you take longer to develop it, the end product will be better. But there's also a discount factor applied. Like, you know, getting science that's 60% as good 10 years earlier might be worth more than getting science that is as good as it could be 10 years later. And certainly in terms of developing the careers of the people whose job it is to build and operate these telescopes, it's kind of a worry that essentially all my colleagues right now who are in their mid-30s, who I kind of went through school with, who are still in this field, are kind of coming to understand the reality that the telescope that will answer the question that they went to high school, they studied in high school, hoping to solve in their career, will probably not be solved. The telescope won't even be launched until after they retire. That's a while.
Yeah. I spent essentially my whole career, with the exception of three or four early years, on what eventually became the F-22 airplane program. So,
oh wow!
I know what you're saying. Maybe that's the whole problem with the way the government has done business, is that it's that by competing and having, you know, supposedly trying to get the best price, but competing between multiple companies, you know, you end up. You don't maintain a staff that just keeps producing, you know what I mean, stuff, you know, just continue as fast as you can. They just, you know, when one company loses, you have to lay off the people, and then people go to the other company. And there's a lot of inefficiency in that approach, plus the need to, you know, put all the subcontractors in every state in the country to keep the Congress backing it.
Well, make it uncancelable. I mean, I understand how that works. I mean, it's kind of the cost of doing business, but... The F-22 in particular, the F-22 absolutely should have been built, right? It absolutely should have been designed and built and hired people like you for their whole careers to build it. But at the same time, we shouldn't have allowed the major aerospace contractors to forget how to mass-produce cheap, effective warplanes, right? Like we're in a situation where, I mean, I don't know very much about this, to be perfectly honest, but we're in a situation where someone was like, well, in order to save costs, we'll just have the F-35 do everything. We'll do close support, we'll do over-the-horizon, you know, air-to-air stuff, we'll do bombing and everything, one airplane. And it's the same problem that the Space Shuttle had, which is that instead of saying, well, we've got kind of, you know, three or four different major mission classes, we'll build three or four major different rockets that they can share technology, but they're kind of individually optimized to these respective components, and they'll be expendable, but the overall launch cost will be less than $100 million. We say, look, what if we rolled everything that everyone ever wanted into one big pile and then made it insisted that it could do that and also be reusable at the same time, and then act surprised that the development program takes, you know, six times longer than anyone thought and costs twice as much, and that the end product didn't work properly and killed 14 astronauts. So I don't know. It's just it's something kind of,
yeah.
So
the nature of the beast.
Degree of wisdom has been lost when it comes to procurement. Put it that way.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'll get off the line, see if anybody else wants to call before you leave. But it's interesting discussion. Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Listeners, you too can call Casey if you would like it as 1-866-687-7223. I have an interesting email from Margaret in Boston, and she says, I have a two-point question for you, but they both center around the same sort of concept. First of all, it seems to me that people just automatically assume there is a huge commercial market awaiting the day that Starship goes commercial, goes operational. How do we know that there's really a commercial market about that? And the next question along the same line is, since Orbital Reef was announced, people are now assuming, or at least I'm reading articles about LEO being a boom for commercial space stations. How is that assumption being made? Do you see a booming market in LEO for commercial space stations. I think you suggested a few minutes ago that you might question the commercial market in LEO. Can you please answer both of those questions?
Yeah, thank you, Margaret. Yeah, these are questions that I've kind of wondered about for a long time, and I eventually decided that I wouldn't be able to know the answer, because it's one of these things where you know, the only way to find out the answer is to build the market and see what happens. And the market kind of determines if the product's going to be produced at a price acceptable to consumers. But essentially, I think the question comes down to kind of taking an educated guess as to what the demand elasticity of launch and of low Earth orbit utilization might be, given a certain amount of cost reduction. And I think, you know, we have a pretty good data point at current costs that you know, the number of business cases that work in orbit are pretty small, like essentially Earth Observation, say Planet Lab, and their competitors, and also various spooky agencies and stuff, you know, military uses, but also communications, satellites, TV satellites, stuff like that. Now, in terms of validating the assumption that it's kind of a coming boom, I think that what we've seen is quite a large number of companies have been founded or have moved into this space. We've had a large number of announcements of companies developing what people call mega constellations, or like constellations with thousands of satellites, as opposed to, you know, 6 or 10 or 50. Whether they are able to execute is another question. Whether they're able to compete with SpaceX is another big question. I would personally hate to compete with SpaceX when it comes to low Earth orbit constellations. I think they have enormous structural advantages because they're able to sell themselves launches extremely cheaply, and they also have really, really, really good engineers. But sure, why not? There's certainly, you know, a lot of private money, obviously, in terms of VCs and stuff. It thinks that this is a possibility, and it's worthwhile investing in these companies on the off chance that it succeeds. In terms of low Earth orbit, people have kind of talked about, you know, custom manufacturing of stuff in microgravity that could be valuable on Earth. I think that is probably true, that there are products that can be manufactured in low Earth orbit that can be sold on Earth, even taking into account transport costs in a way that's profitable. However, all the business cases that I've personally seen, and if anyone has one that they think is better, send it to me because I want to see it. They're very niche cases. You know, they're kind of very niche markets, right? And so in order to kind of cause an explosion of demand for low Earth orbit lab space or something, you need to have something that is both is in business, you know, is able to make money, but it also operates at a scale where it makes a lot of money, right? And so, it's easy to kind of point, just to give an example, it's easy to point your finger at helium-3 or something and say, well, helium-3 is really expensive, and there's helium-3 on the moon, so if you mine helium-3 on the moon, we could sell it on Earth and make money. But it completely ignores, supply elasticity of price. Right. So, like, part of the reason that helium-3 is expensive is because there's not very much of it. Right. So, if you can suddenly increase the supply of helium-3, the price will automatically drop, guaranteed, and your business may no longer work. Right. Secondly, maybe the price won't drop because demand will increase for helium-3 for some reason. Right. But if demand for helium-3, which is incidentally typically used for like certain kinds of extremely cold refrigerators and very specialized applications. And potentially for fusion, although no one's using it for fusion at commercial scale yet, obviously. But if demand for helium-3 increases, then what you'll see is investment in improved helium-3 extraction and refining technology here on Earth. And my personal belief is that it's much easier to make a better helium-3 refinery on Earth than it is to build a helium-3 mine on the moon. And so it'll be very, very difficult for anyone operating a helium-3 mine on the moon to operate at any price or any production level where they can undercut a producer on Earth who, you know, is even slightly motivated. And that's kind of a similar problem with mass manufacturing of anything in orbit. And so really, we need to bring down the cost as much as possible. And I think probably three orders of magnitude should be possible in terms of space station, you know, operational costs in order to test this assumption and to find out if there are actually any businesses out there that can turn over, say, more than $1 billion a year in manufacturing. That's kind of, I think, the minimum buy-in in order to be able to operate in that space. But in terms of industry, there are thousands and thousands of companies worldwide that do more than $1 billion of business a year. So it's certainly beyond my abilities to intuit successfully or completely eliminate the possibility that some number of businesses could do something at that kind of scale and do it profitably in space. And I think, you know, we really just have to build it and find out. And I'm glad that Orbital Reef has been proposed. I hope they go and build it. I know of several other ventures that are also exploring the possibility of building space stations with commercial uses in low Earth orbit. And really the challenge, as I see it, is finding a way of building these things so that they're as cheap to operate as, say, a synchrotron facility or the Antarctic station or something like that, so that researchers can do work there for kind of, you know, $10,000 a day instead of $10 million a day kind of prices, or possibly even cheaper. And I think, you know, the number of businesses out there that would be prepared to invest in and then operate laboratories even in microgravity, if you can get costs down to, you know, between $1,000 and $10,000 a day, is obviously much, much greater than the number of businesses that are prepared to invest when the costs are more like $1 million a day, as they kind of are on the space station. It depends how exactly you count it, but in my case, I'd divide the program costs by the number of hours that are spent on scientific investigation to get the per hour marginal cost of doing scientific research. Because we already know that there are dozens of synchrotrons and private nuclear reactors, research nuclear reactors, Antarctic stations, nuclear submarines, remote research stations, various kinds, underwater, this kind of thing, that are kind of operated on that sort of budget for all kinds of different organizations, non-governmental organizations, NSF, NIH, foreign countries, and then large private companies that do, you know, fundamental chemistry research in order to give themselves a competitive advantage. So I think, you know, if we build it, they will come. Whether, you know, we end up with the low Earth orbit industry being worth $5 billion a year or $500 billion a year, that is a different question. But there's no way we can know until we actually build it and find out. But I think early signs are encouraging.
You have another caller on hold. Good morning, caller. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Hey, Casey.
Hi, John.
Hey, so I'm having difficulty understanding why SpaceX's disruption of the launch market and lowering of launch costs and what they're doing, why that is a negative. I read your blog, and it seemed to be focused on NASA's bureaucracy and how they have to adjust to, you know, the huge explosion of, space industry that's going to happen, that's going to be made possible by SpaceX. And so how is they're changing the way they do business, maybe becoming more efficient and adjusting to what SpaceX is doing? Why is that a negative?
Oh, I think if they did it, it would be a positive. The negative is that if they don't do it, they run the risk of getting crushed, or at least some subset of their business runs the risk of getting crushed. I think it's quite clear that NASA can kind of stay in business doing what it already does, at least to some extent. But the question is whether they can fully capitalize on this opportunity to, you know, what I say is like re-operationalize, right? So like
I'm not saying
that anyone at NASA needs to be fired or anything like that. I'm saying what we need to do is find a way of reorganizing the way that NASA operates such that the existing experts that work at NASA already are able to increase their productivity. Right? So if you're saying we'll increase efficiency, if we define efficiency as the number of tons of stuff shipped to orbit divided by the number of people who work on it, then yes, that's the number we need to increase. And really, I think, you know, NASA has... It's gone through periods of boom and bust, but it is certainly many parts of NASA would benefit greatly from kind of a big organizational push to think deeply about how they can go about increasing their productivity, increasing the amount of hardware that an individual contributor can build, and how much, you know, the various teams can ship, because, you know, it's basically a completely different way of looking at their business than how it's been operated essentially since halfway through the shuttle era.
Well, it sounds like an opportunity to me. I think positively.
I agree.
Of it. So.
Yeah, it's a big opportunity. But at the same time, you know, in the same way, for example, that digital cameras were, would have been a huge opportunity for Kodak, right? They already had all the sales channels worked out. They'd invented digital cameras. They owned a lot of the patents. They built some of the first digital cameras. Consumers are crying out for them. People wanted them for all kinds of reasons. They could sell so many more cameras. It was a, you know, incredible synergy with the rise of personal computing. And yet they decided they would prefer to try and safeguard and avoid cannibalizing their own film industry, which had higher margins, right? Because you sell a camera and then you get to sell the film and you sell the chemicals that produce the film, that develop the film. That was obviously a mistake. But nevertheless, it was an opportunity that they had, that they could have done, that they could have, you know, reoriented the company around digital cameras, which are obviously going to come sooner or later. And they missed that opportunity. And I think that NASA is in a kind of similar position. Although, you know, with the important caveat that at this point, I think the best thing for them to do is to basically, you know, take a really hard look at what Starship actually is and is meant to be, and then decide how that affects them. Because I feel like that step hasn't even been taken yet, at least not universally.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of capitalism, creative destruction. So, you know, they've got some pressure they need to change.
Well, I hope so. Because, like, you know, I work for NASA. I'm deeply appreciative of NASA. It inspired me throughout my life. What they've been able to do over the years, and really, it would break my heart if we go and build these moon bases and Mars bases and stuff like that, and NASA's not part of that story. You know, NASA logo is not slapped on the side of every machine in there, right? And it could be, and it should be.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why it couldn't be. NASA has the expertise, has the workforce, has the funding, has the facilities, has everything we could possibly need. The only thing it needs to do is to say, we see ourselves as part of this future and we insist on being part of it, right? And then actually going and doing it. But if they don't, someone else will, and it'll be someone else's logo on the side of it.
I completely agree. And we need them to be out doing the research, the advanced research of, you know, the next step. What are we going to do further out, you know, and let private industry do the, you know, building the hardware and stuff. And they, I don't know if they need to get involved in the building these huge rockets. I just think it can be outsourced. So, anyway.
Yeah. I think NASA probably could build something like Starship if they, you know, had the organizational structure to support that kind of effort. You know, there's no reason why they couldn't. But it's also fairly clear to me that NASA has been, you know, kind of structurally hamstrung in various ways that improve its efficacy in some areas, but diminish its efficacy in other areas. And one of those areas is you know, basically successfully executing a program like Starship. And I really doubt that that's where NASA's main strength or contribution to this effort would lie at this point. I think NASA and SpaceX have done extremely well by each other, by SpaceX, NASA providing the customer and the money, and SpaceX kind of offloading a lot of the branding risk associated with blowing up rockets. But, you know, in order for that, that relationship to continue deepening and product, you know, productivity and synergy to continue building, you know, SpaceX will either have to strategically mine NASA for its expertise on things like long-duration deep space life support and build it themselves, and, you know, thank NASA for coming. Or NASA can say, oh, well, you know, we kind of missed the boat on launch, but there's a lot of other stuff to be done here. We'd like to be part of it. You know, here's our list of requirements. Does that look right to you? Okay, well, we anticipate having a prototype, you know, on your loading dock in 6 months. We'd like you to let us know what you think of it. And really, that I feel like is the correct approach to take at this point. But, again, yeah, it's a little beyond my pay grade to say so.
Casey?
All right.
Casey, we talk as if NASA can independently make decisions and do things to be responsive or more responsive or even anticipate Starship and SpaceX, for example. But given that they're micromanaged by Congress, and you talked earlier about how SLS is really driven by Congress and it's not the way NASA would do things, just how independent is NASA to be able to react to or to be a leading indicator to Starship or SpaceX?
Yeah, well, I don't see like Congress and NASA as natural enemies in this regard. I think that, you know, on a long enough timescale, it can be shown that the Congress and NASA's interests have aligned, and the Congress has looked out for NASA, and in particular the Congress people that that are really enthusiastic about NASA and take a strong interest have done really great things for NASA. And so my hope is that you know, even though, quote unquote, officially, NASA does what Congress tells it to do, and you know, the FFRDCs like JPL have a little bit more freedom to spend some internal money on kind of long-term business development programs like the Sojourner rover or like the Mars helicopter to kind of, you know, demonstrate and promote a new capability that they hope will feed into future mission opportunities. At the same time, you know, NASA leadership and Congress have a strong and ongoing working relationship, and they absolutely should be feeding ideas back and forth about how you know, new programs should be structured to support these kind of activities. And I don't think it'd be particularly controversial to do this if it was phrased in the right way, because if it was successfully executed, then all the, you know, it's all over a zero-sum game. All the senators and Congress people who are like are all about making sure that business occurs in their district would say that there's a new opportunity to kind of drastically expand the scope and scale of their business and to, you know, improve employment and funding to their respective areas. And I think you know, it's probably time to look past some of the decisions that were made, you know, 10 or 15 years ago to kind of force funding on certain areas, regardless of you know, national priorities or what was needed, or perceptions thereof. But at the same time, recognize that you know, in a way, as I said in my blog, Starship can save Artemis, or Artemis can succeed using Starship, and in fact, NASA can succeed using Starship, and the positive, you know, the non-zero-sum future for everyone is much better if they can kind of quote-unquote get with the program and figure out how they're going to be maximally supportive and help generate maximum value. And so I think this conversation needs to take place. I don't believe that you know, like the Senate director at Johnson or something could unilaterally do this by themselves, and I wouldn't necessarily expect them to. But I would expect that, you know, if they read my blog or became aware of this kind of idea and agreed with it or wanted to go and talk to Elon at Boca Chica about it, that they could, if they think this is a good idea, they should go and talk to Senator Administrator Bill Nelson and say, well, what do you think about this? And then, you know, make sure it gets kind of popped up in the next funding cycle, because how else is this going to happen? You know, NASA is not exactly going to throw itself on the mercy of you know, VCs or something to fund its expansions in this area, although potentially NASA employees could found adjacent businesses to do that. And that would probably be the next best approach, which is take NASA's capability and technology and run it through private money, so you're not necessarily risking taxpayer money on these kind of weird programs, but at the same time, you know, exploiting that long legacy of expertise and knowledge.
John,
well, that's it for me, David. I'll get off the line.
Thank you, John. Casey, I know you wanted to talk about other things other than just your one question, and I know we're coming up on 90 minutes. Can you tell us about the new business you're starting?
Sure. It's actually not space-related. I won't go into too much detail because I respect the fact your audience is more interested in space, and also I'd rather not cross the streams, as it were, between my space enthusiasm and this too much. But, you know, over the last year, I've been thinking a lot about climate change and what we can do about it. And I basically decided that I'd convince myself that at some point this decade, it will become cheaper, in some places at least, to create industrial quantities of hydrocarbons by capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then chemically reducing it and then turning it back into methane or longer chain hydrocarbons than it is to, you know, find oil underground, drill a deep hole, suck it out, refine it, process it, transport it, you know, halfway around the world and then sell it. And in fact, I don't think it's difficult to convince yourself, for anyone to convince himself that this is true, because it's not getting any cheaper to extract oil, but it is getting substantially cheaper to produce electricity with solar power. And so at some point, you know, direct synthesis will become cheaper. And it's just a question is when and exactly how. And so I decided it was time to kind of put my money where my mouth is. I've really enjoyed, it's been a great pleasure and a huge privilege to work at JPL on a variety of interesting missions and projects, but I really feel like strongly that my best bet to giving my children a good future is being part of the solution for the climate problem this decade. And if I solve it by 2030 or 2040, well, hopefully I'll still have a few more years left in the tank that I can go back to working on space stuff. But in any case, I think that that Starship will succeed without me sitting on the sidelines blogging about it as much, perhaps. And there's a lot of very, very smart people who are working on the space problem now. And of course, I retain my interest in it, but at the same time, I think there's a much stronger, much more urgent need for people to solve the climate problem. So actually, if your listeners are thinking about starting a company or doing research or something to help solve the climate problem, they absolutely should. I don't want to be, the SpaceX or Tesla of this particular industry. I don't want to have to vertically integrate and do everything myself. My firm belief is that the fastest path to, basically stopping the net transport of carbon from the crust into the atmosphere is for hundreds and hundreds of different businesses to start up, each of them taking a slightly different approach, many more shots on goal, and it's kind of seeing what turns out to be the best way of doing it, because it's really hard to know at this end of the problem what will work out, and I'd rather not have to hedge my bets.
Are you not going to be doing your blog anymore, or are you still going to be doing your blog?
Well, I mean, regular readers will know that my blog is, let's say, inconsistent at best, so in terms of its timing. Yeah, I'll probably be writing blogs from time to time as the mood takes me. And in particular, I'll be writing a bit more about what my business is doing. So you'll see a few more energy and kind of carbon-focused blogs. There have been probably half a dozen of those over the last year anyway. Every now and then someone sends you a message or whatever and says, oh, have you thought about blogging about this? Or, I'll notice a new thing that I want to write about and I'll write a blog, as I did last week. My blog will continue to contain a mixture of space stuff, energy stuff, travel stuff. Probably a spattering of politics and general geekery. But in terms of my personal focus, I'm really spending my day job hours working on climate stuff.
So I saw a blog article from you a few days ago, but unfortunately I haven't had time to read it for a lot of non-space stuff going on in my life. Scaling carbon capture, is that what you're talking about with your new business and your new focus?
Yeah, So about 6 months ago, some friends of mine asked me to help them kind of understand some friends of mine who are investors, I should say, or potential investors, asked me to help understand how to think about evaluating the relative merits of various carbon companies. And so based on our conversations, I wrote a blog called "So You Want to Start a Carbon Capture Company," where I basically talked about the 20 or 30 most common pitfalls that I've encountered in reading about these various things, ranging from building machinery that appears to operate that actually doesn't work properly, to machinery that uses way too much power or not enough power, inadvertently building perpetual motion machines, that kind of thing. And then talking about the physics and talking about the financing. And this was kind of part of my own journey as well, of kind of coming to realize that not only was this something that was important, it was something that I personally saw myself doing in the future. But then as a follow-up to that, I basically wanted to focus on the electric fuels subset, right? So a lot of carbon capture is about, enhanced weathering or capturing carbon dioxide and then compressing it and injecting it underground for durable sequestration or something like that. And I basically, it's not an original observation, but I became convinced that the best way of doing this was to, the best way of doing carbon capture at scale was to make it pay. And the way you make it pay is you turn the carbon dioxide back into fuel that then people can burn as carbon neutral fuel, and people will pay you for it. You just have to figure out how to make it cheaply enough. And you see, in order to sequester, 10 billion tons a year, it's a lot easier if people are paying you to do it than if you have to get people to pay you to do it, $1,000 a ton or something. So that's kind of why I wrote this blog, and I talked about, all the different implications of this, and I talked about the various challenges of scaling and, the optimal, I talked a little bit about trying to optimize allocation of resources towards things like efficiency versus simplicity versus scale versus different subsystems. And then at the very end, I said, well, it's such a good idea. Why shouldn't I do it? I am doing it. I've resigned from JPL. It's been fun. But I'm going to go off and start a company called Terraform Industries, which is what I'm doing. And, you should do it too. So that's kind of how that blog kind of came out.
I got one more quick question. Can you stay to take it?
Okay. Yeah, of course.
So Dr. Doug sent in his third question for the day. The space shuttle was shut down despite loss of jobs by those who worked on the orbiter. If that happened before, might it suggest that something similar might happen when it becomes clear that Starship is far more cost-effective and more capable than SLS?
Yeah, I mean, one of the major things that was valuable about shuttle was that it provided so many good jobs to so many people for so long. And that was also part of the reason it was so expensive, obviously. But actually, many of those jobs have been retained because SLS uses the same tech stack. Not necessarily the same people doing it, but the jobs themselves exist. Although, you know, a good number of people, I imagine, retired after shuttle went disappeared. It's kind of, you know, I certainly appreciate, like, the value of good jobs, and particularly in areas that have limited opportunities to work on things like this. But at the same time, like, in a sense, that puts the cart before the horse. I feel like if the launch vehicle was delivering value, you know, and it was cost effective, then of course it would provide jobs because there'd be demand for it, right? So it's kind of like the old capitalism versus socialism thing, and there are ways in which government agencies operate that are actually more closely aligned with the planned economy, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that, you know, aspects of the economy have to be planned, but certainly in this case, I think it's a big missed opportunity. And one of the things I pointed out in the SLS blog, I think, the SLS blog, which came out about a year ago now, is that, you know, you could have effectively decided to give all these people UBI instead, right? So just basically keep paying them the salary or some fraction of the salary forever. And it would still cost less than the SLS program. So, you know, I have to be careful to phrase this in a way that doesn't unnecessarily offend people. I think it is important for the government to invest money in building out programs across the country that provide opportunities for people to do technical jobs, to develop industry, and stuff like that. No argument for me there. I think that's absolutely necessary. I don't think it's the role of private industry necessarily to do that. I don't think it makes sense for them to do that. I think if you look at how, for example, SpaceX has developed, almost all their work is being done in, like, a handful of buildings, right? Like, people are all in one place, which is, you know, counter to a goal of a government who sees its role as spreading wealth around and spreading opportunity around and making sure that there's a broad industrial base across the country, right? That's all necessary. That's all great. And a lot of work on the shuttle and on various space programs and stuff is done by kind of Mar and Par machine shops that have the capability to produce these parts to extraordinary accuracy. And which are actually kind of a strategic weakness right now because a lot of people are nearing retirement age without necessarily having found a place for themselves. But on the flip side of that is that a lot of the industrial processes that were developed around servicing shuttle, particularly in the southern states, particularly in the historically underdeveloped southern states, were shuttle-specific. So by basically forcing NASA to continue subsidizing these machine shops and factories and stuff that were building shuttle parts that were, frankly, obsolete by the time the first shuttle even flew in the southern states, you're not actually necessarily building out industrial capacity to support bootstrapped, like, indigenous industry that can kind of grow and maintain itself within these organizations, right? So, like, ideally, you'd see a situation where you've got, like, the government is supporting a major industrial operation, an arms factory or whatever, in a city, but then you also have, like, a whole series of ancillary businesses that have their own businesses that kind of have synergy with that, right? So, like, they might be suppliers for that, but at the same time, they might also be customers for that, and they might also have their own customers and suppliers outside of that city, and they're all kind of developing this stuff. And I think you definitely see, like, that in Huntsville, for example. But many of these other places, you really don't see that. What you see is a company town where there's really only one employer, and they make widgets that are only useful for that one employer, for their particular device. And in many ways, that's job security because, you know, you could never close down that factory or your space shuttle won't fly anymore. But at the same time, it also really impedes the ability of those people to go about, you know, actually building a vibrant economy in their own community because it remains dependent on this government largesse. That's kind of, you know, kind of a problem. It's kind of a shame. So that's kind of what I have to say about all the shuttle jobs and the ongoing kind of development of SLS. I wish there was a way of doing this in a way that kind of induced additional demand real demand for this kind of technology or technological industrial development in the South. Because, you know, the people there know what they're doing. The NASA employees know what they're doing, but, you know, they don't have, after they've done their 40 hours a week, they don't have the time or energy to go off and, you know, build a parallel business actually developing and delivering value to their own community. And so, you know, that is the sense in which I think kind of giving them all a very, giving them the option of taking a very generous severance would have allowed them to invest their time and money in stuff that actually makes a real market need. But, you know, one has to be mindful of what is politically possible.
Anything you want to offer in summary or conclusion, or should we have asked you something that we didn't ask you that you think we should know about?
So I think we've been very thorough, and I think we had a great opportunity to kind of cover the wide space here, including a lot of these, you know, interesting rabbit holes. But I guess, you know, my central point is, like, I'm not trying to criticize NASA here. I understand it's a very large organization that is structured around doing a certain subset of things extremely well, and by and large does those things extremely well. But I really, you know, as I said, it will break my heart if Starship succeeds, Elon and Jeff Bezos go and build their giant space stations and moon bases and Mars bases, and NASA is not, you know, a major part of that story. There's no reason why it shouldn't be. All it needs to be to do that is for the decision makers involved to take Starship seriously and to understand what it means, and to begin laying the groundwork now to avoid being taken by surprise later on. And at this stage, all that really means is kind of getting the thinkers together in a room and kind of hashing out, you know, what's going to happen and who's going to do it and how it's going to happen and who's going to do what. We don't require, you know, a $5 billion investment to build a new factory to mass produce, you know, Mars rovers yet. But certainly, you know, that sort of thing needs to be discussed. So that's my advocacy. And I hope I don't have to write too many more blogs on this topic.
Well, we'll see. We'll still be following your blog, and we wish you great success with your new company. And hopefully, we can talk to you about that later on when you get it up and running and going. And you want to do some interviews and talk to people about what you're doing. I'd be happy to have you back on the show for that as well.
Oh, thank you. We could have a non-space show. It's a ground show. It's actually, just as a parting comment on that, one of my key observations is that, although I spent my entire life, you know, kind of in aerospace and aerospace adjacent industries, where I spend my time and expertise figuring out how to optimize the crap out of any given subsystem, you know, sucking all the air out and making it really light, really performant, really, it turns out that in order to successfully scale the carbon capture business, you have to do the complete opposite of that. You have to deliberately take complexity out of the system, take design out of the system, just to try and make it as simple and as cheap as possible. So it's a very interesting intellectual exercise. And I'd be very happy to come and talk about it.
Well, we'll look forward to it. And to you and your family, a great Thanksgiving and a great Christmas and New Year's season. I look forward to talking to you next year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Casey. Listeners, that's it for today. And we thank you for your emails and calls. And remember, open lines on Sunday. Goodbye from Casey, David, and The Space Show. As always, keep looking up. One more time. Goodbye from here in Petaluma in The Space Show.